America Trends Podcast is part of the MHNR Network. MHNRnetwork.com.
What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived, and it's just in time.
Welcome back to America Trends. Every election cycle, we debate how accurate the polls were. Is that even the right question, since there's always that caution that this is just a snapshot in time and we have those well-posted margins of error? Maybe a better question is what value these polls have in the first place, and whether they crowd out important information during a campaign, like the stances candidates are taking on major issues. We turn to an expert today who jumps in with us on how the realm of polling on everything from candidate preferences to preferences on all manner of issues, even whether you prefer Coke to Pepsi, are of any value in our society. And if so, why? It's an important conversation, as many discussions on the topic are limited to whether 2020 pollsters learned anything from 2016. We go there and far past it today on America Trends.
With us on America Trends is Daniel Cox, and he's with the American Enterprise Institute. He's a research fellow in polling and public opinion, and he's also the director of the Survey Center on American Life. And Daniel, why don't you give us a little snapshot about the Survey Center on American Life?
Relatively new. We started last fall, and it's been a continuation of my work. I've been working in public polling in one form or another my entire career. And that's really focused on providing journalists, folks in the media, public policy professionals, corporate nonprofit leaders with basically tools to understand, what's going on in American public life, in American lives, their economic lives, their social lives, and to get a better grasp on the problems facing Americans, today. And so I think one of the things that we've always wanted to do, that I've always wanted to do, is to move beyond kind of the partisan national squabbles that kind of dominate a lot of our, national news coverage, and to get, underneath that, what are the values that Americans bring to these debates? What are, how are they experiencing a lot of this stuff? They don't spend a lot of time arguing about the minimum wage, probably, but they may be having a hard time, putting food on the table and, affording their mortgage or their rent. And so I think those kinds of issues, getting a handle on how people are, living their daily lives, I think was something that we thought there was an opening and something that'd be of value.
Oh, absolutely. And I've got to tell you, you and I are in sync, because I wanted to get out of the daily squabbles that I was involved with when I was doing a talk radio program. And I wanted to look more at where we were headed socially and politically. And so I think we're here together on the right podcast. Let me say that. And I do want to talk about polling, because polling is a big part of American life. You've been a part of it your entire professional life. And I think you make a really interesting point in something I read that you said, which is polling is one thing for an election, but it really is another thing as it relates to our desires, our hopes, our aspirations, our wishes. And it's actually more important in the latter context than it is in the election process.
That's correct. And unfortunately, I think for those of us who don't do, campaign polling and election polling, that's the public's main sort of entry into this profession, into this type of research, is campaigns and elections. That's when they pay attention to it. That's when it gets all the, garners all the media coverage. But there's a whole slew of research that relies on, gathering people's feelings and understanding their experiences that has nothing to do with politics. And so I think when we have these debates about how accurate polls are in predicting an election outcome, that's an important debate to have, but it is utterly divorced with all the other work that is out there that has no political content. And so I think, if we're going to have that debate, let's have it about one aspect of what polling does, which is try to get a sense of, where we are, during a particular election cycle and who's up and who's down. And, there are, people who think that's very important, many of my colleagues and friends. But I think, again, just one piece of what, polling can do and how it can, inform our decision making at the local, state and national level.
I want to get back, of course, to the polling around the elections, because I think a lot of people thought it was way off, though I don't think it was really that far off. But let me ask you this. When we look at those issues that you say are really important for us to understand outside of the election cycle, let me throw one on the hopper, and you tell me if this is a good example. When we look at, for example, the issue of vaccination and the way the American public reacted initially to Warp Speed, how quickly it was coming out, was it politicized or not, and you saw a lot of reluctance and a lot in minority communities to being vaccinated. Now, having that information, to me, seems really important to policymakers to say, we've got an issue here. It's a big public health issue. What good is having the stuff if nobody wants to take it? And that will not lead us back economically and socially. So I think that's really important information to have.
Yeah, absolutely. And there are entire organizations dedicated to doing that kind of work. The Kaiser Family Foundation does absolutely incredible polling on public health issues. And obviously, the COVID-19 coronavirus pandemic, they've been all over that. And understanding, they're not the only ones who've been pulling that, but they've done a lot of great polling there. But understanding who's willing to get vaccinated and why, the sort of reason for this reticence is incredibly important if we're going to address it and try to achieve herd immunity, which is going to take some doing.
Absolutely. When you look at other issues that you consider vital to have the pulse of the American public on in order for somebody to make a decision about something. I mean, are we really talking about legislators? Because between elections, do they know what it is their constituents are really feeling? Or they can, of course, through different means, through town halls and such, through letter writing, whatever the campaigns may be. But do you think it's really important to politicians, to whom do you want to address a lot of these polling issues and say, you really need to have better information before you make a decision?
Yeah, and we know from the vast literature in political science on political activism that the people who are writing letters, who are contacting the member of Congress, they tend to be disproportionately people who are socioeconomically better off and not representative of the general public. So if I'm only, I'm gauging what my constituents think only by who I'm hearing from, I'm not really getting a complete picture. And one of one of the reasons polling is so powerful is we have a representative sample from the entire country if we're polling nationally. And so we can get a sense of, there's important differences between these communities. And a lot of these communities who you don't hear from often, low-income communities, communities of color, who are disproportionately underrepresented in a lot of these political activities, we have an opportunity to sort of say, hey, look, there's, some significant variation among the public in what people think about particular issues, how important they are. And I think it's on us to really raise those voices of people who aren't, regularly profiled or seen in the public.
Recently, I did a podcast about attitudes that Americans hold about abortion. Now, this generally is polled in a certain way. Are you for abortion? Are you against it? But the methodology that this University of Notre Dame professor and five other sociologists used, where they basically sent out a questionnaire and said, we'd like to talk to you about an important social issue. And they didn't say what it was, Dan. They just said something important, because they know immediately alarm bells go off when it's abortion. And then they did in-depth conversations with these individuals, and they found out, for example, that abortion is much more nuanced, or that one in four of the people who were interviewed for this extensive research actually knew somebody who had had an abortion, and they thought about it in, again, a more textual way. How likely are we, if we use some of the traditional methodologies and we have 1,000 people standing in for the nation, that we are really going to get a true understanding of what the public thinks? Is it in the questions? Is it in the way we select the individuals? What kind of combination of approaches do you need to get information that really is important and valid?
Yeah, no, I think it comes down to, you know, having an appreciation for some of the limitations of public opinion research and closed-ended questions in particular. When we talk about the issue of abortion, yeah, it's been heavily polled. We have a really good sense of where, you know, the public is on that issue. And the most, you know, most Americans are somewhere, you know, in between the extremes of, you know, legal in all cases and illegal in all cases. And that is something that's been unstable for a long time. But there's a lot that, yeah, as you mentioned, that one policy question does not get at. You know, how important is it to you? Yeah, do you know anyone who's had this experience? You know, and so I think, like, you know, the sort of moral questions behind it. And so I think, you know, one of the things that we can do is we can rely on some more qualitative type of research. We can, you know, provide open-ended responses and surveys to let people express for themselves, you know, how they feel about a particular issue. And so I think, you know, we don't need to be handcuffed to a particular question style or design. You know, we can be creative in how we ask things and the way we approach them. And I think that's something that I'm always looking to do. You know, I appreciate the ability to track trends over time, which means asking questions in a certain way, the same way over time, but also that we should be trying to break new ground and understand the complexity of these issues. You know, is a perfect example, you know, something that is extraordinarily complex, and that is Americans' belief in God. We recently redesigned this question to get at, you know, uncertainty. You know, in the past, you know, Gallup's been asking about, you know, do you believe in God, as a yes or no question since like the 1940s. And what we want to do is build off of, you know, existing research in the 70s and 80s, the Pew Research Center and Gallup, the General Social Survey started asking about uncertainty among believers. So if you believed in God, how certain were you in this belief? But what had never been asked was how certain people who did not believe in God were. So we wanted to ask the whole entire group how certain they were in their beliefs. And lo and behold, what we found is that people who did not believe in God also expressed a degree of uncertainty in their beliefs. And so I think, like, that paints a much more complex picture about the nature of certainty around belief in God than a simple yes or no question does. And again, it's on us to sort of think through these really complex questions and try to get at them from a number of different angles.
You also say that when we look at the polling, particularly for elections, because that's where, as you say, most people meet the pollster, if you will, or they are inundated with this polling information, you say that reporters should contextualize these polls more by using additional information such as historical voting patterns, registered party identification, more on-the-ground reporting. But oftentimes when I see it, and I'm somebody who really gets very interested in the issues in a campaign, but they're often dwarfed by this racetrack mentality, who's ahead and who's behind. So how do we combine the importance to some of knowing who's ahead and who's behind, and you can explain why that's important in an election, because sometimes we don't know when we're voting for mayor or oftentimes for state representative. We have no idea who's ahead, and it doesn't bother me not to know whether my candidate is ahead or behind. But how do we give context to it?
Yeah, that's totally right. There's a number of different ways to get at, you know, truth, to get at factual information. And I think any time we're dealing with complex questions, we should try to use all the methods available to us. I also think there's a tendency, and I see this a lot in the media, that, you know, when someone's reporting on a new poll, that is like the only poll in existence, right? That, you know, there's no other polls that are, you know, could be brought in to provide context. And you know, I think increasingly, you know, people are starting to address this, but I think it's really, really important that we don't think, you know, our poll is the only one that matters, right? That we, you know, this research is being produced and conducted, you know, in an environment where there's a lot of other work that we can look at and sort of see how, you know, where does this fit in with the existing research landscape? And it certainly requires a little more work on the part of journalists to do that and sort of say, well, this is, you know, really consistent, or maybe it's not consistent with what's out there. But I think it's really important. And I tell, whenever I talk to student groups who want to know, like, you know, can I trust the polls? What should I do? And my answer is always, you know, look at what else is out there. There's so much polling research that is being done. Look for polls that are really transparent in their methods and the questions that they ask, places that have a good track record producing reliable results, consistent results. And so I think, like, that, those are all really important things. And, you know, if you are seeing a poll that looks really different from what else is out there, instead of saying, wow, you know, things are really different, well, maybe that poll is a little bit of an outlier, and, you know, we should treat it a little more carefully. So I think, like, that is sort of an important thing to remember when we're dealing with polls, particularly new polls.
Why is it that they think it's so important for us to know who's ahead and who's behind? All of the candidates in a major race for the U.S. Senate or for president, they've got their own private polling. It goes more in a granular way to what it is that they want to know, where they have to be on the ground, where they have to put their resources. Why do we need to know?
Oh, I think because Americans become so emotionally invested in politics, I think to an almost unhealthy degree. And, you know, because of that, we're always hitting refresh on, you know, what is the latest polling model, the polling aggregators say, is our candidate up or down? And I think this obsession, with who's up and who's down in a presidential race, I think is really unhealthy. There are so many issues, you know, that deserve attention during a presidential race. There are, you know, an innumerable things that we might focus on, you know, problems in the country that, you know, could provide important context to, you know, to a presidential race. And so I think, like, you know, who's winning and who's losing, like, the whole idea of covering this as kind of a horse race, I think is inherently problematic. I know it generates news clicks, and so we're unlikely to move away from it. But I think, like, to the extent that we could provide a lot more nuance and detail around these elections in terms of what people are thinking, how much they're engaged, you know, how much they even thought about the election, it would be really helpful. And then the other thing is, like, there's a lot more than just the presidential election in any election year, right? There are mayoral races, there are legislative races, there are state house races. And so I think, like, you know, looking at the full range of political decisions that people are making would be pretty helpful to know as well.
Daniel Cox is with us from the American Enterprise Institute. He's a research fellow in polling and public opinion, and he's the director of relatively new, the Survey Center on American Life. We'll tell you how you can find their studies as we move along. Do we often conflate polling with prediction?
I think, you know, so much of what the, you know, the current state of election polling is, like, you know, how well are we predicting the future? Because, you know, polling was never designed to be predictive, really. You know, it was meant to create a snapshot in time of what the public thinks about, you know, a particular issue. And, you know, that individual may change their mind. So, yeah, trying to judge 4 months out how someone is likely to vote and whether they're going to vote is the other thing. You know, there's a lot of time gets spent building these election models to predict who is going to turn out and who is not. Because if you don't capture the right group of voters, even if you get them, you know, every single person in that sample votes how they said they were going to vote 4 months earlier, if you don't have the right group of folks, then your results are going to be off. And so I think we're asking a heck of a lot of this particular research methodology that we don't ask of any other research methodology. You know, we don't hold it to the same standard, and I think it's unfortunate. If we were, you know, if we could be a little more honest, as, you know, as pollsters and folks in the media about the limitations of polling, I think we'd all would be better off, you know, sort of saying, hey, well, we know that, you know, this stuff is particularly difficult to do. It's kind of amazing that we are as accurate as we are, even with some misses. And then focus on, ways that we can get better. There's certainly been a lot of experimentation, a lot of advances in survey methodology, along with some challenges. Response rates are dropping. It's getting more expensive to conduct traditional telephone interviews. People are not answering their phones. There's a decline in trust. And these are all issues that the industry is confronting. And I think, it's important, and it's on us to sort of be honest and explain that to folks. And I think sort of say, well, there are some limitations to what we can know, when we can know it. And so I think, just communicating that is important.
Well, I think it's really important to understand, as you say, the methodology, the in-person, which used to be the standard, is gone. You have hard phone lines, and they're going. You've got cell phones, digital devices. You've got all of that going on. Then you've got all these changes in the way we vote. So you poll somebody who's already voted because they have early voting, and maybe something that goes along in the last 4 weeks of the campaign they actually have no interest in because they've already submitted their vote. Or you've got pollsters who pull up a week ahead of time, and a lot changes in that week. So you've got this roiling sea of activity and changes that somehow a pollster has to account for.
Yeah, exactly. And so, I think it is helpful in all the kind of election polling we do is, painting with a really broad brush in terms of, the overall questions that we're asking. So, we should ask the question, who are you voting? But we should also ask a lot of other questions. How often do you vote? What other kind of political activities are you engaged in? Now, how many of your friends are voting? One of the things that we found is, knowing people's social environment is fairly predictive of their political behavior. So if all your friends supported Trump, you're likely to support Trump. If none of your friends voted, you're not likely to vote either. And so I think those kind of questions can provide really useful context.
So let me ask you the question. 2016, everybody said, wow, did they get it wrong? And of course, there's been so much written about all the improvements that were going to be made toward 2020. And in 2016, there were a lot of people who said there were these secret Trump voters who didn't want to admit that they were Trump voters. And then the question was, well, in 2020, have you figured out a way to account for those individuals who may be reluctant to say that they're voting for Donald Trump, but quietly and in their own way, they are supportive? So did we get at that in 2020? What did we change from 2016 to 2020?
It's important just to be honest and sort of say, the polling did not perform as well as it had in the past, but it wasn't off by much from the sort of historical record. There are some states that the polling captured quite well, like Georgia, and others like Ohio and Texas and Florida, where there's a significant miss. Nationally, I think the polls were only off, I think, 3 or 4 points, which, again, is not a lot when you consider all the variables that go into this. And I think part of it is this expectation that polling is always going to be, provide incredibly accurate estimates, when that's really never been the case. There's always been some bias, there's been some, degree of kind of messiness in these estimates. And so one of the challenges, I think, is just communicating and trying to set people's expectations on all this stuff. The other thing we know about Trump is that we did see during both Trump elections that, he was bringing out voters, particularly folks who, described as like white working class voters, who tended to be more mistrustful of the media, of elites, of pollsters. And so I think they were disproportionately disinclined to participate in polls. And so I think we did miss them. I wrote a piece about this, about how people who were socially isolated were far more likely to support Trump than people who had more social connections. And those folks were disproportionately likely to participate in a variety of different activities. So they weren't likely to be civically engaged, to socialize, and to participate in politics. And to the extent that Trump was able to pull those people to the voting booth, that was a really impressive thing. But what it also did was, bring out a bunch of people who were heretofore invisible to the pollsters.
You worry about bad actors replacing reputable players if we really demean the work. And by the way, after the 2020 race, there was a lot of condemnation. I know Frank Luntz, I've met him in the past, and of course he's a respected Republican pollster, and he really laid into the industry, and others did too, saying, wow, you can't do this again because you're going to lose trust. And I'm wondering about the industry itself, because as you said early on in the conversation, we see so many numbers, and then we see aggregates of those numbers, real clear politics and the like. Who should we trust? I'm wondering myself, who pays for all this polling? Because you know it better than I do, Dan. This is expensive stuff to do well.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And I think the first, you know, and most important thing is you should trust people who are willing to let you behind the curtain, to look at their method, to look at their approach, and to share that with you. Anyone who won't share that information publicly, you should not trust the results. And so I think like there's a movement in public opinion research, and the American Association of Public Opinion Research, which is the umbrella group for pollsters, their kind of academic home, is committed to this idea of transparency, and they've started something called the Transparency Initiative, which encourages all pollsters, if they want to join it, to do a variety of different things, which is, you know, from releasing the full questionnaire that they used to sharing information about who did the data collection, you know, who they contacted, all these things, and even you know, releasing the data, which is what we do at the Survey Center. We release all our data after a period of 6 months. And so if folks aren't willing to provide you that information, you should view any of the results with skepticism. And I think that, you know, my own opinion is that people should publish that stuff without people asking for it. It should be just out there. And then people can judge for themselves, like, you know, about how you asked, you know, certain things. We had a poll out today that, you know, asks, you know, questions about complicated topics, stuff about conspiracy theories. And so the way you word a lot of those things really matters for how people think about them and how they answer them. And so, you know, we never get it right. We're not perfect. So people can judge for themselves. Do you think this is a fair question? And you can look at who we contacted and how we contacted them and judge for yourself. But I think that's a really important part of this is allowing educated consumers of this stuff to be educated, to get the information that they need to draw their own conclusions.
Do you want to say anything about the expense of mounting these polls?
Yeah, no, it's exceedingly expensive to do well. You know, one of the challenges in this era now is that you can conduct polls for really cheap, and you couldn't really do that in the past because of these new methods that have been developed that are not really that well tested. So you're having a lot of folks coming out there with not a lot of this, you know, experience doing this work, whose intention may not be to educate and inform, but maybe to push an agenda, you know, whether that's sort of a financial agenda or a political agenda. And so I think it makes it a lot harder. You know, I think we need to be reasonable in what we can expect from the public who are not experts in this stuff. And so, you know, who can I trust? There's like a dozen new pollsters coming, you know, out with polls now. And so trying to make sense of that is really tough. And I do think that for those of us who are in this for the right reasons to, you know, to be helpful, to educate and inform, you know, the best we can do is to serve as kind of exemplars, right? So we're saying this is how we think it should be done. And I think hopefully people will follow suit.
How worried are you about proprietary polls? Meaning, well, even the news releases that came out with data, not polls, but information about the effectiveness of a vaccine or not that came out from one of the companies. And people look at that and they assume, well, that's credible. I must be able to rely upon that because it's been reported openly by sources that I appreciate. And yet then the FDA has to go and test that and so forth. But we see a lot of polling that is put out by the industry involved saying if you take antidepressants, it's really good for you. It helps 70% of the people. And then we find out that that was funded by the industry. How do we know that? Because sometimes we only read the top line information.
Yeah, well, and here I think that there's a symbiotic relationship between pollsters and the journalists who cover polls. And I think, you know, part of our job as the pollster is to be transparent. And again, that includes who funded the poll. We did a recent survey for the Knight Foundation. And so we put that information, you know, right in our methodology page, which is on, you know, the same page as the results. So I think, you know, journalists need to do their due diligence and sort of say, you know, who is conducting the poll, who funded it, because that's important information to share. Now, just because, you know, someone from an industry conducted a poll, you know, doesn't mean that they're necessarily unreliable results, but, you know, you should take it with a grain of salt and look around and say, well, does this comport with what else is out there? And if it doesn't, well, you know, you can start asking some questions.
Let me just get back to one question about election polling. How much do you think polling motivates voters, and in what ways? By that, I mean, if I see that my candidate is way ahead or I see that my candidate is way behind, do I get motivated to work harder? Do I get deflated and say, forget about it? I mean, does it have an impact? Does it become part of the game?
Yeah, no, I think there is some evidence in political science that it can serve as a demotivator. So if you think your candidate has, you know, no shot, my understanding of the literature on this, and I haven't done research on this myself, is that it's not so clear cut. So people who are trying to game the system by putting a lot of shoddy polls out there that, you know, show their candidate far and away leading, it's unclear how beneficial that will be. I do think in terms of how candidates and campaigns operate, you know, they want to be able to show positive news for their candidate, right? It helps with fundraising and it helps with, you know, getting volunteers, the whole campaign, the energy of the campaign. And that's important. And so sometimes you'll see people leaking internal polls, and those, you know, are almost always cherry picked, right? So if I'm conducting 20 polls during a campaign and I leak one, I'm probably leaking the one that is best for my candidate. And so you're not seeing the other 19, you're just seeing the one that looks good. And so again, you know, we need to be really careful about, you know, how we go running off with, you know, these internal polls from campaigns. And it doesn't mean that it's wrong per se, but they're probably sharing their best stuff and leaving the other stuff on the, on the cutting room floor that we won't ever see.
And because you run now the American Survey Center for the American Enterprise Institute, you must want your information to get out to a broad group of people. And there is so much polling. We're almost drenched in it today. I know there's a group that I've had on as a podcast subject called Study Finds. And I believe they're out of, I don't know where, they're international. And they'll put out some really interesting stuff that grabs my attention, and I'll get them on from time to time. I mean, we're all kind of fascinated with what others think, aren't we?
And I think it's one of the really important things when you live in a really diverse country with people having a variety of different views. You know, part of being a part and living in the U.S. is understanding what your fellow citizens think. And I think so much of polling allows us to move beyond our own personal experience to try to have a shared experience with others. So it's like, wow, you know, this is some, you know, how African Americans are treated by police in the U.S. is very different than how the experiences white people have with police. And we know this because of survey data. And so I think like those kinds of things where, you know, we are able to learn something about the experiences of people who are different from us. It is really important and can help bridge political divides. You know, we're so divided now. And I think a lot of that comes down to this lack of shared experience. We, you know, we get our media from different sources. Our friends are more often than not having the same political views as we do. We live in communities where people share our racial or economic backgrounds or educational backgrounds. And so this kind of sorting is inherently human. You know, we see it across cultures and across time, but it's incredibly problematic if you want to try to build any kind of consensus around issues. You need to be able to understand how people whose lives and experiences are different from your own think about the world, their perspectives, their worldview. And so I think polling is one way we can do that.
Well, something that you put out recently, Fewer Americans report being proud to be an American. Only 34% of Americans say they are extremely proud to be an American. Though I hear that Lee Greenwood song in the back of my head as I'm saying this. And only 28% say they are very proud. Despite this, most Americans believe the world would be better off if more countries adopted American culture and the American way of life. I was noticing another study recently where more Americans are giving up their citizenship than ever in the recent past. So there's a lot here. Do you want to say anything about it?
This is a trend that we picked up from Gallup. So we asked the same identical question that they did over the past, I think, 15 or so years. And Americans, by and large, have, you know, since this has been asked, have been really proud to be American. And you see this idea of American exceptionalism, that, you know, the U.S. is in some way special in the world, that we have things to offer in our culture, in our way of life, our political system, you know, that we can be kind of that city on the hill. And what we're seeing now is a kind of reevaluation of that. And there's, you know, there are fault lines along age and religion and politics. And it's really significant in that it's shifting pretty significantly over the last few years. We saw a decline in people saying that they're proud to be an American. But again, there's also these really important divisions. So young people are much less likely to say that they're proud to be American or buy into the idea of American exceptionalism. We find that white Christians are much more likely to say they're proud to be an American than believe in the idea of American exceptionalism. And then one of the things that a lot of these polls, then, you know, one of the things I get excited about when we find findings like that is like trying to understand why. You know, the polling is very good at telling what. And then yeah, we could certainly follow up with, you know, more questions, but I think it's also really helpful just to get people in a room to listen to people, whether it's focus groups or in-depth interviews, and to try to get at those complex answers. Like, why do people think this? Why are these differences? What is it about young people that make them less likely to be proud to be an American? Is it they haven't been completely socialized yet? Is it that they're growing up in a very different cultural and political environment where their financial future is more in doubt? They're less likely to believe that they have an opportunity to get ahead. There's more dissension and discord in our political system. You know, so what will happen? Will these young people stay this way, or will they as they age become more inclined to look like their parents and grandparents now? And so those are kind of the really interesting questions that a finding like that brings up, and something that I think we'll probably continue to explore.
Well, I'd like to have you back as some of your polling comes out and we look at trends in our society. So I hope you will take that as an invitation. The American Survey Center. And you can find them at AmericanSurveyCenter.org. Is that the best location to find all of your research?
Absolutely.
All right, great. Well, I want to thank you, Daniel Cox. Great talking with you today from the American Enterprise Institute. And we will have you back again on America Trends.
Absolutely. My pleasure.